And I'm going to talk about concurrent programming. And this is not going to be, this presentation and the next couple are not going to be about my research. There will be fragments of my research here and there, and there will be my treatment of the subject, especially in the middle lecture and the way the third lecture is presented. But really, I'm just going to give a general background of concurrent programming and especially multi-threaded programming. So again, this is very general. And I was very happy to see this morning when Chandra asked who has done programming with threads. She asked who has done programming with pthreads. So can I ask the same thing and see the same people? So who has done programming with pthreads? So more than half the people. Who has done programming with Java threads? Again, more than half the people. So that's excellent. It means that much of what I'm going to say is for the introduction is not that necessary to you. I'll still give the introduction for 30, 45 minutes or something so that everyone can get to the same speed. And hopefully the people who have seen it before will not be too bored. But trust me, there will be new stuff coming up afterwards. Now, the goal is that we're going to build from the principles of thread programming, the programming model that has implicitly dominated the way we program concurrent systems today, which is monitor-style programming, and it's what you have implicitly learned every time you program with threads. And from that, we're going to see what are the weaknesses of the model and how this leads fairly naturally to what's called transactional memory, which is a new proposed model that you may have heard of. So who has heard of transactional memory? Okay, who is doing work on transactional memory? One, two. Okay, that's great. That's fantastic, because there's only very few people who do work on that, but everyone is hearing about it, and everyone wants to form an educated opinion about what it is and whether it's the next big thing. So that's exactly what we're going to discuss, why some people think that transactional memory is the next big thing. But we're not going to get to that until later in lecture two. So today, no transactional memory, just old-style, monitor-style programming. So you've all seen the background. You've seen the slides on Moore's Law. This one is something I stole from Shanshan, who stole it from people at IBM. And
I made it up myself.
Really?
Yes.
Okay, I thought the data was from IBM at least.
The data might have been itself.
Okay. So number of transistors doubles every 2 years. Those are the blue dots. And this is barely visible, right? Can people see my pointer from the back? Yes. Kind of. Okay. So number of transistors doubles every 2 years. You can see here time and number of transistors. At the same time, there's something else that's growing, and that's the power density. And these are the yellow dots here. And you can tell that these follow, especially lately, an upwards trend. And if we were to follow that, some very, very scary things would happen. Namely, people who have plotted these plot several other data points on this curve. And you can see if we were to just follow this and keep the same technology and double the number of transistors and suffer with the same technology the increase in power density, we would very quickly get to some very, very scary stuff. So you know that for reasons of power, we cannot exploit Moore's Law the way we did in the past. So you've all heard of multicores. You've all heard how our hardware is becoming parallel. And at the same time, you've probably also heard how parallel programming is very, very hard. Now, up front, and this is probably the most important thing that you need to remember, even if you don't care at all about the rest of my lecture, there are many ways to do parallel programming. I'm only going to talk about one. That one happens to be the most raw, most general, etc. Other people may say, no, well, I'm doing language design, and I don't want to care at all about multithreading. That's too primitive for me. I want to do everything like Erlang does, with strict separation of different little programs and strict message passing. No shared memory, nothing like that. So what I'm going to talk about is multithreading. I'm not going to talk about agents. I'm not going to talk about message passing. If you have a different paradigm, sure, that's fine. You can definitely build very exciting languages based on that, but it's not going to be the most general thing that people can use to build all the applications in the world. The most primitive, most general thing will always be multithreading. So that's the level of abstraction we are talking about. And transactional memory as well is exactly in there. So when you hear those buzzwords, transactional memory, very popular. Where do you place it in your mind in the whole landscape of concurrent programming techniques? Well, it's certainly a subcategory of multi-threading. The moment you talk about transactional memory, you assume threads. No message passing agents or no strict message passing agents, et cetera. So all of these are suited for different kinds of parallelism. And we can talk in more detail if you're interested. And by the way, you should interrupt me. And I think that after the second lecture, this will become very obvious because I will interrupt myself and ask you things and we'll do things on the board. But in the first lecture, you should take the initiative and interrupt me because otherwise I'll just lecture about things that may be boring. But if you interrupt me, it's going to be much more exciting. So I will only talk about multithreading, the most explicit parallel programming model, as I said. And you've probably all seen threads. That's going to be a negative question, but I'm going to ask it regardless. Who has not seen threads before? And please don't be shy. That's the problem with negative questions. Now I got zero information. I don't know if really no, there's no one who hasn't seen threads, or people just don't raise their hands. So you all know, or most of you probably know, what a thread is. A thread is an abstraction that captures the execution of a program flow, a control flow. So execution of instructions the way we're normally used to executing them. Go, do assignments, while loops, ifs, etc. But all the threads that are in the same process, they operate on the same address space. They operate on the same data. They have a shared memory abstraction. So if we want to think about the standard model of execution, a process is an address space in most standard operating systems. So that's our entire memory. And same for runtime systems like a Java VM. And threads operate on the same data in this space. So if I have data floating on my heap, all threads can access all the data. So threads can interfere with each other. One thread can go mark something that the other thread will see as marked. People over there cannot see this, right? Yeah. OK, so I'll try to minimize writing on the board while the screen is down. But the point is that threads share memory, so they can mess up each other's results. And more specifically, they share the heap and global variables. They share what's known as static storage and what's known as the heap. And what do they not share? Threads have some memory of their own. Otherwise, it wouldn't be meaningful. How do you start them and they do different things? So they each have an individual stack. So threads start, and they all have a stack of execution. And each thread can follow its own path through the program. And it can do recursion, or it can do method calls on its own stack. Now, probably you're all aware of this, and we will see it in many more examples. So what's the way we program multi-threaded systems today? It turns out that most thread programming nowadays is what's called monitor-style programming. So this was introduced in the 70s, and it has pretty much dominated all alternatives. It's the basic programming model that we have for multi-threaded programming. And by alternatives, I mean semaphores, low-level atomic operations. There are many things that people express still using alternatives. You will occasionally see algorithms expressed using semaphores. You will occasionally see code written using semaphores. But the most general, most approachable thing is monitor-style programming and has been integrated in languages. I mean, Java has native support for it. And it's great. It's a nice thing, but it has some pretty serious problems when it comes to software engineering behavior, like the reasoning that we need to do to make sure that our program is correct. And that will be my hidden agenda for lecture 2. So we're going to do some examples together, and we're going to see how hard it's going to be to get some things correct. Although you will get them 95% correct, I will be surprised if you get them 100% correct. Maybe a couple of you will, mostly by luck. And based on that, we will be able to go ahead and say, oh, here's what we just observed. That's why this is hard. That's what leads to transactional memory. And then, of course, we will do a lot of discussion on transactional memory as much as our time permits. So the outline is what I said before. Basically, and the limits are not hard here, so we will take as much time as necessary. We will have lecture one basically be monitor-style programming, traditional multi-threading. There will be a bit of a boring introduction. We already started on that. We'll talk then about the complexities of the programming model in lecture two. We'll do some examples. We'll probably start doing examples online even today. And finally, I will take as much time as necessary because this is open-ended, and I will talk a lot about transactional memory, how exactly it addresses all the previous complexities, and then all sorts of alternatives for implementation. Any questions so far? Yes.
Why do you use the most general way of doing parallel programming?
So, in a general way, first of all, because it assumes it supports shared memory, which is the most powerful you can get when you have when you have multiple parallel processing elements. Anything else, like message passing, is based on an assumption of no shared memory. It's a distributed execution, effectively. You have distributed address spaces, and you only exchange data in very, very disciplined ways, as instead of just accessing anywhere you want in memory. Now, you can do that. You can do message passing even when you have real shared memory underneath, and then you can have a whole lot of optimizations trying to recover the performance of shared memory, passing programming model. But in a certain sense, if you accept message passing as your primitive programming model, you're giving up. It's like saying, I will program nothing in an easy way where I have shared memory. I will program everything as if nothing is shared. I will program every shared memory machine as if it's a cluster or as if it's a bunch of machines over the internet. Now, if you're willing to give up, and for many applications, we're willing to give up, we don't want to program algorithms that are tightly coupled, then that's perfectly fine. And maybe we should have specialized languages for that. And there are many languages that are being proposed. I mentioned Erlang before, but it's not just Erlang. There are also parallel languages for specialized applications, for streaming applications, for instance. All of those are much more specialized than multi-threading, and they have very strong domains of applicability, but they will never be fully general to give you unlimited access to the full power of shared memory parallelism. Yes?
Forgive me, because I'm just learning some of this myself, but my other understanding of the other trade-off here is that message passing paradigms, in particular the actor model, also have a lot less overhead. I mean, the reason that they exist in Erlang or Scala in part is that you can have a great many more actors running simultaneously than you can threads for the same cost.
That's an implementation. So there can be very lightweight threads. There are many thread approaches that just create fibers, what are called, or many or other kinds of lightweight threads that do not suffer the cost of an unlimited length stack, for instance. And you can certainly have millions of threads if that's necessary. The question is, what would you use that for? So certainly, if you know that you won't need a full-fledged thread, maybe you can remove some of the overhead more easily. But it's not the case that one cannot offer a programming model with threads that removes most of the overhead as a default and then only lets you have full threads when you really need them. Dynamically expands the fibers into full threads, for instance. So I'm not buying that. That's more of an implementation concern rather than a programming model concern. OK, so monitor style programming, which is the programming model we have started talking about, the dominant one. Monitor style programming is based on two components, and I bet everyone has seen the first one, or most everyone who has done multi-threaded programming before. Everyone has seen mutexes, or often called just locks. And think of them as data types that support a single operation, lock, and implicitly an unlock. So when we're done with the locked segment, we unlock. And if you want to see a mapping to Java, since many people have done multi-threaded programming in Java, so the keyword lock is very much like synchronized in Java. And you can use synchronized in Java in many ways. You can use that as an annotation at the method level, or you can use it as a block-structured statement inside the body of a method. So we'll see that. You'll see what I mean by that. The second component of monitor-style programming, which not everyone learns by default, is condition variables. Now, who has done programming with condition variables before? Okay. I mean, I think fewer people than who has done programming with threads in general. So what we're going to try to do today is establish good well-formedness conditions for programming with mutexes and condition variables together. So condition variables are data types with primitives like weight, signal, and broadcast. So you can do three operations on them. So I'll tell you exactly what these are, but there's a straightforward mapping to what we have in Java. So in Java, the weight operation of a condition variable is a method in the object class. So every Java object is something that you can call weight on. And similarly, every Java object is something that you can call notify on. And notify is the abstract operation signal on a condition variable. And similarly, notify all is just another name for broadcast. It's the Java name for the operation that I call broadcast. So if you've done Java programming, this is what you need to remember. Synchronized wait, notify all is lock, wait, signal, broadcast. And feel free to ask me later for a reminder. Now, of course, there are many other incarnations. We start by asking who has done pthreads programming. So in pthreads, the same primitives map to slightly different syntax. So we have explicit mutex and condition variable objects. So I declare things like pthread mutex t and pthread cond t. This is a mutex, this is a condition variable, so this is a type. If I say pthread mutex t and I declare a variable of this type called v, means that variable is a mutex. And similarly for condition variables. Whereas in Java, every object is implicitly a mutex. Every object is implicitly a condition variable. But then our lock in pthreads is just pthread mutex lock, pthread mutex unlock. So at the end of the locked section, I need to say explicitly unlock. And then wait signal broadcast are just pthread cond wait signal broadcast. Just a different mapping of the same programming model. Now, pthreads is pretty much the way we do multi-threaded programming in everything that results in native code, C, C++, whatever you compile down to a Windows or Unix executable. So for our discussion, we will assume the most general model, which is a bit more general than the programming model of Java. And I'll point out later why I'm not very happy with the programming model of Java. So I will diverge a little from what Chandra said in the morning when she said, oh, Java makes it so much easier to do multi-threaded programming. That is true, but the default model is a bit broken if you want to do really well-principled multi-threaded programming. So I will use an imaginary language with the full power. So I will have lock and then wait signal notify for condition variables. And I will express condition variables explicitly as objects of type cond, instead of just using the native Java way of having every object be implicitly a condition variable. But it's very similar to regular Java programming. It just gives me a bit more power that I will point out where we're going to use it. Now, and I will use synchronized, just like Java normally uses synchronized. And by the way, this is a programming model that you can very easily get in Java through library classes. The concurrent classes in Java 5 already have pthread-style condition variables, so you can actually get what I'm expressing here. I'm just going to be slightly higher level than regular Java. We'll see in examples. Now, thread creation generally is an uninteresting detail, so you will never see in my examples how to create a thread. It's boring. In every system, there's some way to create a thread. You create a thread, you give it a starting point, and goes ahead and runs. What we care about is how to prevent threads from getting in each other's way. But in Java, for instance, you create threads as subclass. I mean, threads are objects of class thread or any subclass, and they begin execution when you call their start method. That's one way to create threads. OK, so most of you have seen mutexes, so you know much of what's on this slide. Mutexes are used to control access to shared data. A mutex means that only one thread can execute inside a synchronized clause or inside a locked, inside a statement that's preceded by a lock. And other threads that try to enter synchronized code are blocked until the mutex is released, until the mutex is unlocked. So again, remember that in Java, every object is a mutex. On every object of the system, I can say I want to synchronize on that. So very simple example. If I have a class list and I say synchronized on the insert operation of list, that's a synchronized annotation on a method. In Java, that's the same as saying I have an insert method, and in the body, I synchronize on the this object. So every object is a mutex. I'm using the synchronized clause here on the pseudo variable that represents the current object. And that's the same thing as writing this keyword up here. Simple enough, right? So what does that mean? If I have two lists, can I call two operations, two insert operations on the two lists at the same time in two different threads? So who says yes? Who says no? OK, so my question, let me rephrase it, and maybe it will get a bit more participation. My question is, I'm synchronizing on the this object. If what does that really mean? I'm synchronizing on a certain object in memory. If I have two objects of type list, I have list 1 and list 2. I have two threads that want to try to insert separately in those two list objects. Since the list objects synchronize on this, what does that mean? Can the two threads do the insert at the same time? Yes. So everyone agrees. That's what it means that we synchronize on this. Now, what if I have two different names? So I have two different variables, list 1 and list 2. And they happen to point to the same object in memory. So I have aliasing. Can two threads using the two different variables, one thread is using list 1. It says list1.insert. The other thread is saying list2.insert. Can they insert at the same time if list 1 and list 2 are names for the same object? OK, we understand the basics. So no. So object identity is the key here. We will see that later. When we say why some things are very hard, one of the reasons why things will be very hard is the whole concept of object identity. But we will see that even if you remove all concerns of aliasing, even if you go to a language without aliasing, it will still be hard to program well with monitor-style programming, with monitor-style constructs. So the prototypical example of mutexes is something like this. And it's short enough to fit on a slide and then good enough that I will use it 3 or 4 times in the future. So I have an account class. And my shared data will be a field of account called balance. And then I synchronize on the identity of the current account object. And I have methods withdraw and deposit. And they're both synchronized. And what do I do when I withdraw or deposit? Well, for withdrawal, I do a simple test. I have an amount. I check if the balance is greater than or equal to the amount. And if it is, I take off the balance. I take off the amount from the balance, return the amount. Otherwise, I return 0. And similarly for deposit. So can someone give me an example of an error that's being prevented by having this kind of synchronization? What am I not allowed to do that would be a problem? I can still miss out on a deposit or withdraw. I'm not sure I'm following exactly. So what could be operations that would normally happen concurrently that would cause a problem? And with this synchronization, I don't allow them to overlap.
If I have two deposits happening at the same time, or one withdrawal and deposit happening.
Oh, I see what you're saying. OK, yes, precisely. So if I have two operations happening at the same time, how could they interfere? For instance, how could I have a withdraw and a deposit interfere with each other? Well, an easy way might be that the deposit operations, you can think of it as happening somewhere in the middle. Is there some point in the middle where interleaving the deposit inside the withdrawal will cause a problem?
After computing the balance,
I'm not sure that will cause a problem. Like right here, probably it won't. Right after the condition will certainly cause a problem. I've already committed to making the withdrawal. I've done a check. The check may no longer be correct. Or is that right? Actually not. In this case, before the if, what? But that's okay. I'm sorry?
After the else could be a problem because basically you've determined that there's no money in the account, but then the deposit is actually happening.
That's no problem.
So my point is that anything, if this were to take place at the top or if this were to take place at the bottom, the two operations serialize. They're as if they executed one before the other. Yeah. So actually, we need to break those assignments here in order to cause a problem. So if these assignments are atomic and we assume that all that the system can do is interleave operations, I think that right now, without thinking more about this example, is that there's not going to be a problem. The problem is if this is not atomic and instead of balance minus equal, I really do... where is it? TMP gets balance minus amount, and then balance gets TMP, that's going to be a problem. Yes? So that's another problem. Withdraw and withdraw can interfere with each other right here, if we interleave them right after the check. But withdraw and deposit, we need to break up the atomic operations. So we already saw how many problems we found. And all these problems that we found are under the assumption that the only thing that the runtime system is allowed to do is interleave operations. And that doesn't even happen to be the case. That's not true. The runtime system can do a lot more. It can reorder operations. It can break them up into little pieces. So runtime systems can do whatever they want. The compiler can introduce lots of optimization in the middle, or the low-level memory system of the machine may introduce a lot of stuff in the middle. So certainly, we need to be introducing synchronization to have any guarantee of correctness for our multi-threaded algorithms. So hopefully, since most people have seen this before, I don't want to belabor the point, but do we think we're okay with that? Okay. So we'll return to this example and see how, when we try to build up from this, there will be lots of complications. So one of the major issues that arise with mutexes is deadlock. And you've seen deadlock, you know it as a term, you've seen it in everyday life. The most obvious example, deadlock, is when we have two threads and they have a cyclic lock dependency. For instance, thread A locks mutex M1, thread B locks mutex M2, and thread A tries to acquire mutex M2 and blocks, while thread B tries to acquire mutex M1 and blocks. And there are certainly many techniques for avoiding deadlocks. For instance, we can try to reduce the risk of deadlock by having finer grained locking. We can try to schedule our execution in a way that all the locks are acquired up front. And if we cannot acquire any of the locks that we're going to need in our future, we release all the ones we managed to acquire. And we can also try to have a global ordering of locks in our system and make sure that all threads acquire the locks in the same order. For instance, if you have a linked list, if in your mind you always maintain the invariant that all the locks are acquired left to right, and you do that for all the threads, there's never a possibility of cyclic dependencies. There can never be a cycle created. Is the second one also a guarantee of no deadlock? So what's the problem with having the second one? Why don't we do that all the time?
You need to know upfront which locks you need.
Yes. That's going to be a big distinction later on. I'm not going to make it explicitly, probably, but it's going to be a big distinction to keep in the back of your mind between transactional memory as an arbitrary programming model versus transactions in databases. In transactions in databases, we know upfront what tables we're going to access. And most of the time, it's perfectly possible to know upfront what locks you're going to need in transactions in databases. Well, not always. If you have very fine-grained locking, you may need runtime information to compute it. But certainly, if you want to create an arbitrary programming model that's based on transactions, that's going to be an issue. You cannot know upfront all the locks you're going to need. So if you want to avoid deadlock with a technique like that, it's not so easy. And similarly, it's not so easy if you're going to do that explicitly in your own programs. It's not easy to know, oh, I'm going to start now, I'm acquiring this lock. What else am I going to need to acquire before I release this one? You need to know everything you're going to call it to do. That's part of the big problem of multi-threaded programming. And now we're getting to the more interesting stuff. So condition variables are the other half of monitor-style programming. And they're used to wait for specific events. So these are used especially for very long waits or indefinite waits when we don't know how long we're going to wait. And examples could be, let's say I have a garbage collection thread, and my garbage collection thread sleeps until some condition is satisfied. So sleeps until the free memory gets low. And when any other thread tries to allocate and finds out that free memory is low, it signals, it notifies the garbage collection thread. Or more specific, the condition that now memory is low, and the garbage collection thread that happened to sleep on that condition is now walking up and goes and does its job. Or, for instance, we may have periodic events like, oh, there's some timer that expired, go now and refresh a window. So these kinds of long events are exactly what we use condition variables for. Now, intuitively, before we look at any of the constructs, could we do the same thing with mutexes? So could I use mutexes to code up an indefinite wait? With mutexes, I have shared data. They're in memory. I can have a disciplined way to access them. I can say lock and unlock. And I could just be polling, right? I could be checking. Is the free memory low? No. Let me wait. Is the free memory low? No. Let me wait. I could be doing that, right? So I could be expressing the functionality I'm saying I'm up here in with mutexes, or not. Yeah. So why do you think we don't do that? It's very expensive. So we really don't want to do polling. And it's also very architecture specific if you want to do it in a way that is high performance. Really, condition variables are a way to delegate all this responsibility to someone who knows about the architecture specific elements of our program. So they know how long to wait before they poll a condition. And why do polling at all? In condition variables, we typically have a wait queue, so the thread is waiting, and then asynchronously some other thread is notifying it. But even if there is some polling, if there is some spinning on a condition, that's done in a very efficient way. The thread does not go to memory all the time to try to get the new value of some memory word, which would destroy performance. So there are really very good reasons for never doing this with polling or spinning, and always doing this with condition variables. Yeah. That's the next slide. Yes, the moment you're signaled and you start executing, you have a lock in your hand with a condition variable. So each condition variable in every system, in Java or in pthreads or any monitor-style programming system, is associated with a single mutex. And that goes to what you were saying. If you're signaled and you start executing, you have that mutex in your hands. Not right away. We'll explain exactly when. Now, in Java, every object is a condition variable, and I'll tell you later why I think that this is ugly and makes for an inferior programming model. You will see that in examples. You will see errors that are going to be introduced with that. So this is one of the slides that is in your handout. It's just for people who are not too familiar with condition variables, just a refresher, and we will refer back to it. So there are just four slides in your handout. And when we're going to be doing examples, you can go back and refer to them and trace through. And this one, it's just because I had the space. It's really the last two slides that I really wanted to have as a handout, because otherwise I would need to write them on the board and have them permanently there. So a condition variable in our imaginary language will be a type cond and will have operations wait associated with a mutex here. And wait will atomically unlock the mutex and block the thread. So the thread will now say, I'm going to go to sleep on this condition. And I'm not going to do anything until I'm waking up. But before I go to sleep, I will atomically unlock this mutex here. And I say here as many times as needed, because mutexes can be locked and then locked again and then locked again as long as the thread that's doing the locking is the owner. At least that's the case in Java mutexes. That's called a recursive mutex. It's really a good aspect of a monitor-style programming model. Pthreads does not have that. In pthreads, you can have self-deadlocks. If you lock a mutex and you try to lock it again, you can deadlock with yourself, which makes no sense. That's another bad decision of an implementation of a fairly good programming model. But we will assume that mutexes are recursive, like in Java. So the other two operations are notify, or what I called before signal in most general terms. And notify awakes some blocked thread. And the thread is awoken inside wait. So inside, in the middle of the wait operation, the thread wakes up. And the first thing it tries to do when it wakes up and it gets removed from the sleeping queue of the condition variable is it tries to lock the mutex as many times as it was unlocked before. And when it finally succeeds, it returns from the wait. And this is a subtle point here that we will see later again more vividly. The fact that there are two different states inside a condition variable. A thread may be sleeping on that condition variable. It has not been woken up yet. Or a thread may have been woken up. It's not in a sleeping queue, but it's waiting to acquire the mutex. It's still not making progress. It's still blocked on a mutex. It's still not running, but it's not sleeping either. So it's between step one and step two. And finally, notify all is just like notify, but for all blocked threads. So all the threads that are sleeping on this condition are woken up. They're removed from the sleeping queue, and they all try to make progress, which means they all try to lock the mutex. And whoever succeeds, the first person, the first thread, is going to go in and execute. At the high level, are we good with that? Should we go to examples? OK. So simplest possible example. We have a buffer. And let's say this is a very simple producer-consumer example. So let's say we have a buffer that really wraps just a port variable. And I have a condition variable here. And in all my examples, I won't care at all about initialization. Multithread initialization is a complex issue. You need to understand the language. But in most cases, there are shortcuts so that you don't need to think about it. So let's assume that I have such a shortcut. And everything that I declare as a class variable, as a member variable, when I create the object, it gets initialized, and it's fine because it's before any thread runs or it's done with perfect synchronization. So forget anything about when this new code runs. Imagine that it exists when my buffer code runs. So I have my condition variable, and then I have two synchronized methods, produce and consume. And any thread that calls consume is implicitly a consumer now. So what does that thread do? The thread says, while the port is empty, I will wait. And it passes this as the mutex that it needs to unlock for the wait and relock later. And this makes perfect sense, because this is also the mutex that we locked when we started executing consume. That's exactly the meaning of this synchronized annotation. So we start executing consume, we lock a mutex, and here we potentially unlock it if we run this wait. After I'm done with the wait, what invariants do I know hold for sure? I certainly have the mutex in my hands. No one else can access my shared data protected by that mutex, as long as I've written my entire program so that all access to the shared data hold this mutex first. And then, what's my shared data here? I'm assuming that the shared data is port. So every access to this port object is done while holding this object for this buffer. So now I'm the only owner of port, and I can do whatever I want with a port. I can just say process data, for instance, or whatever else. Now, this is how I wait until I'm enabled to run. How does someone let me know that I'm able to run? So I'm waiting on something that says, if the port is empty, I'll wait. Well, if someone adds the data, or if someone adds data to the port, they know the port is no longer empty. So what they can do is call notify down here and unlock, wake up all the threads that may be waiting. Or I'm sorry, with notify, they will only wake up one thread that is waiting. OK, so who's clear on this example? Let me see a quick show of hands. OK. So this is our very, very basic condition variable pattern. That's the simplest thing that we can do with condition variables. And in fact, half of the things that people do with condition variables are exactly producer-consumer cues. Nothing more complex than that. Now,
question?
Yes.
Why did you write the while?
Let's get to that. Why not?
Thank you. Yes, other question before?
No.
Answer to that?
Yeah.
Please.
Well, because there might be one thread waiting in the queue.
Yeah.
And if all of them are awakened at the same time, then all of them would try to process the data.
Well, but I only notify one, right?
I didn't say notify all here. So what you just described is not doesn't quite work.
Yeah, it does, but it's
complicated. Yes, correct. That's
what I'm trying to get you to tell me. By the way, this is a big thing. You never, never, ever wait under an if. Always you wait under a while. That's a big thing. In fact, it's worthy of having a language construct just for that. And there are language constructs. In the 70s, there were language constructs called serializers that combined together the wait with the condition that you're waiting on, and they had implicit signaling when that condition was satisfied. And we will see the same kind of implicit signaling later when we discuss different variants of transactional memory. We will see transactional memory with conditions. But the question that we're having now is, OK, I just told you, you always use this pattern. You always say, while some condition, you wait. Why while? Why can I just not say, if some condition, I wait?
Couple of threads could think that they satisfy, that they both satisfy the condition, and then they can do that.
So
that's true. So more specifically, what would we have in that example? Like, give me names for those threads.
Producer, etc. So think of a case where I have two consumers.
As many producers as I want, and I have two consumers. And one of the consumers comes in and says, I will wait. Now, down here, the producer ensures that the invariant is satisfied. There's data in my port. Port is not empty. And calls notify. There's no guarantee when this code is going to get to run. We said when we call notify, this thread here will wake up, but then it will try to acquire the mutex. That's a competition. We never know when it will get to acquire the mutex. It may be 3 hours from now. So some other thread can come in and get the mutex in the meantime and empty the buffer. So if we want to program defensively, we always have to have a while with a condition that says, what conditions should be satisfied so that I am enabled to run? And we should not rely on the external world to tell us when we should be able to run, because the external world is unpredictable. Should I repeat the example, or did people get this concrete example? Think of two consumers. One of them is sleeping. One of them is waiting. The other is not waiting yet, just doing something else. And before the first one actually manages to acquire the mutex, the second one goes in, acquires the mutex, the top mutex here, the synchronized block, goes in and consumes the data. There's no more data to consume for the one that just got woken up. If I only had an if, it would just go in and try to process data that's no longer there. And we can try to generalize from that after I take a couple of questions that I saw in the audience. Yeah.
Yes.
Reasoning about performance becomes quite tricky.
You mean
with the if?
Why? So with the if problem, we created a mechanism to make sure that the program was correct. But yes. Now, if I want to figure out how long it takes for me to consume a certain item, I have to reason about how long would I get stuck inside that white loop.
Right. So
monitor style programming does very little about ensuring progress. You're basically on your own about ensuring progress. So how can you ensure progress yourself and have some bounds on what you guarantee? And also, how do you ensure fairness? Neither fairness nor progress are guaranteed in any way, only safety. So the burden for ensuring fairness and progress is on the programmer. What the programmer can do is have a while condition here for all the other threads that says, is it fair for me to run? And if I run now, do I mess up anyone else's progress? And only then I will go through, otherwise I will wait. So you have to explicitly, with monitor style programming, encode fairness and progress yourself. All that the pattern will give you is safety. But you are right, it's going to be complex. And we will see examples later when, I mean, I will just tangentially mention that. I will say, what if you wanted to ensure fairness here? And we'll see that's going to be hard. You'll need to write the protocol explicitly.
So I buy your argument that for robustness, you want the while there, right? Because if you were to change this code, then you could get bugs if you had a dip rather than a while. Can you just clarify, with the code as it is right now, is there a way that it can break with an if?
I didn't talk about how many threads exist. So I didn't change the code at all. The example that I gave is with this code. Imagine that I've created three threads.
But each thread only takes a piece of data out per signal.
Correct. I have three threads.
T1 is calling consume and gets blocked on the wait. T2 is going to call consume, but it hasn't gotten to it yet because it's trying to acquire the lock, let's say. T3 goes in, produces, calls produce, and now puts some data in the port. And now T3 calls notify and wakes up T1. But before T1 gets through, T2 acquires the lock finally and consumes the data. With just this code.
The problem is that it threw the condition without having to actually wait. So that broke the
It
didn't get through their condition at all. Right, exactly.
T2 didn't ever wait.
Correct. T2 never waited.
But they have to wait because there is a synchronized.
So it
wait here.
Block on the mutex. So it's trying to acquire the mutex, which just means it's going to be the only thread to be executing either this code or this code. But it doesn't. T2 never waited in this example, never actually called c.wait.
So if, even if it's T1 in waiting, and it's actually inside of the synchronized body, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then T2 still can enter.
When you wait,
you've already released your.
Even if you're in a synchronized body, if you're in a waiting state, you don't have exclusive access. You've already released your lock. Yeah?
hypothetical idea, but what if you got rid of the condition altogether and only did wait? So now you reestablish this correspondence between the signaling and the data.
You mean I don't have the while, right?
You don't bother to check whether the port is empty. Mm-hmm. All you do is wait.
Yes.
Unconditional.
Well, then the problem will be that if the port is full,
someone comes and produces two units. And then I try to go in. I wait. There will never be any notifies coming later. So I wait forever. I just deadlocked. You see them? You see what I'm saying?
I mean, you can pick that another condition.
No one has come up in 3 decades with a better, more elegant way to fix all the problems of lost signals and all the problems of deferred signals, etc. That's the way we have come up with. But sure, you can come up with ideas, and I'll try to knock them down. But just give them to me one by one, and I'm pretty sure I can tell you why they don't work very quickly, because I will just pattern match them to what I know works, and I'll just take the diff, and I will create an example for that diff. Well, let's go.
We should.
If we want to care about fullness, if our port could be full, we should have a while loop here. So we never should make progress without taking that the conditions for making progress are not satisfied. So every time we're in a synchronized block, we should say here, while port full, wait. Otherwise, after that, I'm continuing. Yes?
So
I told you one of the reasons that will break, and I'll give you two more. But
okay.
Yeah.
So now you're saying we're using a while, and now the code is probably correct. But one thing that I'm quite at pain with is that how do you specify correctness in, for even such a simple example?
Okay. I don't know how to answer that. I'm not trying to make a formal argument of correctness. What I call correctness is the following. When I am going to go to the statement after the wait, this condition here, which should be my enabling condition, is false. So the negation of this condition is true. So I know for sure now that this is holding in terms of my global invariant on the data. And I also know that I have a lock that prevents everyone else from changing the data underneath me. So that's what I call correctness. So that's why while, getting to my second point, that's why while is extremely defensive programming, and it's an amazingly good practice. It means I don't care about what anyone else does. Once I get to after the wait, I know the exact invariant that I stated in the while, or the negation of that. And the other good benefit of that is that I can replace every notify with notify all. And we will see later that this alone, if you don't care about performance, if you only care about correctness, this alone solves a ton of problems in multithreading. If you over-signal, if you wake up all threads and just let them run, and your program is correct because you specified the conditions in the while correctly, then you're great. So I can replace notify by notify all, because when I have the right conditions here and I have a while, the threads will sort it out whether they're runnable or not. I don't put that responsibility on whoever notifies. Whoever notifies just notifies the whole world. I mean, not the whole world, the threads that are sleeping on that condition, which is a great property. So you really, really want while here. And in fact, this is such a crucial property that implementations of the monitor-style programming model are allowed to implement wait as a no-op. I'll repeat that. Pthreads implementations give you no guarantee that wait is anything more optimized than an atomic unlock and no-op. Wait can be just unlock the mutex and then do nothing. The responsibility of spinning, the program will still be correct. Why will it be correct? Because you created the condition here inside the while. And Pthreads implementations actually explicitly in the POSIX standard, it said that they're free to just return. Unlock the mutex and return. Not maintain any queue. Don't do anything fancy. And you want that. Yes?
Wouldn't it be more like unlock and then lock again?
Correct. I'm sorry. It's unlock and then do nothing but unlock again. Actually, unlock lock. You're right. That's exactly what I should have said. Unlock lock. Yes?
So by symmetry, if we produce, if it were to move, if it were to wait, it would notify the duration. Why is it true?
And that's correct as well. Over-signaling, just like notify all, notifying at all the at all times is perfectly correct as long as the while conditions are set up correctly. That's why it's so important to set up the while conditions correctly. You can over-signal. You can underweight. You can do whatever you want because the safety is guaranteed in your while condition. You know for sure that when you return from the wait, you have all the invariants you want, and you have exclusive access because you have the mutex held. Are we good with that concept? If we are, you got condition variables. That's the wonderful thing about condition variables. That's it. Nothing deeper. Yeah?
On notify, if there are multiple threads that are hanging out waiting on the condition there, which one is woken up by notify?
So the answer is
any one.
Okay.
I mean, implementations may tell you the first thread in the queue. Doesn't matter. As a programmer, you don't know which one is the first thread in the queue. So the right answer from a programming model standpoint is any one can be woken up. No guarantee. Just one, though. In this one, it actually, if we assume one consumer and one producer, it wouldn't be different. If we assume multiple consumers, the right way to notify all. Wake up all the ones that are waiting. Yeah. I'm sorry? And live lock with notify all. No. We can cause slower performance. So the threads can wake up, and they will all try to acquire the mutex. And one by one, they will acquire it. And they will check the condition, and then they will go back to sleep. But it's not going to cause a live lock, strictly speaking. There will always be at least one thread that will make progress. The same thread that you would call, if your program would make progress with notify, then it will make progress with notify all, just slower. Okay, so if you are armed with mutexes and condition variables, you can use those to implement any kind of critical section you want. So you can very, very easily create methods enter and exit in a critical section class, and then use this use an object of this class. Imagine that this is lowercase cs, and say cs.enter. And that's going to be the signaling for entering my critical section. And my critical section will be anything between the enter call and the exit call. So I can use my mutex and condition variables as building blocks and build my own synchronization primitives. I can do it. They're universal. I can have any code here. And that's the general pattern for doing that. And that, if I remember correctly, is number 2 or number 3 of your handout slides. So this pattern is something we will refer to in our examples. Today, homework, and next lecture. So what does the pattern look like? Well, it's very much a generalization of what we saw before. So we will have shared data, and our shared data will include a certain condition. And then I will say synchronized void enter, for instance. While some abstract condition is not satisfied, I will wait. I will change the shared data to reflect that I am in the critical section now. So I will change the shared data in such a way that everyone else's invariants reflect that I am in the critical section. They shouldn't run or they shouldn't do something. The only way for other threads to see that I'm in the critical section is by changing the shared data. And then I may need to notify here, which is kind of a tricky case. Now, there may be multiple ways to enter. I'm just showing one enter method here. But we will see later examples where you will have three different ways to enter a critical section, for instance. But they will all follow the same pattern. Just like what Olivier was saying before. What if I have a critical section where I want to check if the port is empty and if the port is full? So I will always have two different conditions here. I have two different ways to enter there and know that I'm in the controlled section. And generally, there is a simpler, there is a specialized version of this pattern where you're just exiting. You don't need to wait. You know that you were in the critical section. You know that there's nothing to prevent you from exiting. So you just change the shared data to reflect that you're out of the critical section, and then you notify as needed. This notify as needed and this notify as needed, we will see, are the source of lots of errors. Even if you were to do multi-thread programming with no races, you always protect everything correctly, just the logic of correct notifications will be a problem. Yeah?
There was a question in last slide about replacement of condition variables with message passing.
Yes. Okay. Good. Thanks for reminding me. I forgot about that. So the question here is the following. Well, by messaging here, I mean, what if I had, instead of the weight, something like the following? I need to write. Now, unlike RAS, I'm not skilled with a tablet, so I'm going to try here for the first time to draw online on the tablet. So instead of this, what if I had, imagine that I have explicitly an unlock statement. Let's say I'll call it unsynchronize, so I'm unlocking my mutex. And then I just say, listen for message. And then again, lock my mutex. Now, this doesn't work too well with Java because it doesn't have explicit non-block structured lock and unlock constructs. But imagine that I can lock and unlock here. So think of, I'm unlocking, listening for methods, locking, and then all that the producer needs to do is send me a message. What would be, would that be valid? Is that the same thing as waiting? If I were to call close the brace, it's here. So all of that is instead of the wait. Just think of this as unlock lock. I mean, I tried to invent things. So lock, unlock the mutex, lock the mutex again. Is that equally correct?
Well, what happens to a message that gets sent when nobody's listening? Is it still there or?
That's the issue. That's the well-known lost update or lost message problem. That's exactly the problem that Dijkstra first solved with semaphores in the 70s. That's exactly what old-style Unix signals had for a long time. Many messaging facilities have this problem. The issue is, what if the notification, what if the message arrives exactly at this point? After I've unlocked, so really now the message can arrive, someone can write to my shared data. So the update comes here, and before I start listening. That's why we said wait has to atomically unlock the mutex and put the thread to sleep. Nothing can come in the middle. No update to the shared data can come in the middle. So if someone was to notify us and change the shared data, they certainly cannot do that right here. They either have to have done it before, in which case they had to do it a lot before, like before I even acquire the mutex in the first place, so I would see their update, or they have to do it after I go to sleep and notify me. So no, you cannot replace condition variables with messaging. It would have a very subtle race condition, which is one of the most celebrated race conditions in the history of multi-threaded programming. OK? So yeah, we got to that, and you also have this on the on your slide. So let's try to do the simplest example possible based on this pattern. And it's kind of a reflective example, so kind of boring, but very, but still instructive. So what I want to do is use this monitor style programming pattern to implement an unstructured mutex. Do you remember what's the easiest way to turn this off if I unconnect? I want a blank screen. I think last year I had to create a special slide that was just blank. Actually, you know, if I go to the very end of my presentation, it has this blank slide. No, don't turn the projector off because I'll need it. Let's give me just a second. I'm sorry? I could fill in the details. Can people see? Okay, let's do this. Just in this case, the size fits us. So imagine that what I want to do here is use mutex and condition variables to create a mutex. So seems like a waste. The only difference will be that the mutex I'm going to create will be an undisciplined mutex. It will be an unstructured mutex. It will have operations acquire and release, unlike the Java mutex, which only has a synchronized and has an implicit release at the end of the synchronized block. So what shared data do I need to do to have? So you refer to the slide that says, this is the general pattern of monitor style programming. And it says right at the top, first I write my shared data. So what are my shared data in this case? I'm sorry? Is there any thread in the critical section? OK. So can I remember that as a Boolean, or do I need to remember that as an integer? Can there be more than one in the critical section? This is a mutex that we're building. Let's say it's not recursive for now. Let's make it easy. It would be the same, though. The answer would be the same. For recursive, we'll need some more shared data. It's a binary mutex, or?
If you want to just a binary mutex, it can be Boolean, the data.
It's only one thread in the critical section, yes. So it's mutex. So by definition, mutex is mutual exclusion. There will be only one thread in there. So I can probably get away with just a Boolean. So let's write, is this a board? No. Good thing. So imagine that up there I have Boolean someone in critical section. Or let's just call it locked. And imagine that it's originally false. And this is before, this is a member, before our methods. What other shared data will I have? Condition variable, just like the previous slide says. Condition. Let's give it an unexciting name, uninformative name for now. And I think that's enough in terms of shared data. Let's see later if we need more. So what will my logic be for acquiring that mutex? So what does the pattern say? While. We always start with a while. OK, so it's the opposite of my enabling condition. So I wait when I'm not enabled. I'm enabled if the mutex is not locked. So I wait if the mutex is locked. So while locked, I'm waiting on this. This is kind of by default, because that's the mutex I've locked. That's the mutex I have in my hand right now. I don't have a second one. So of course I would wait, and when I wait, that's the one I unlock. So it wasn't even an issue of asking you which mutex I'm unlocking. If I had multiple in my hands, I will have to decide which one I'm unlocking. And by the way, that's a big source of, that's another subtle source of problems with multi-threaded programming. You may have multiple locks in your hands, and you unlock only one of them with a wait, not all of them. So that's an issue of bugs. I mean, there are people who write papers about mechanisms who find exactly these kinds of bugs. So we're good so far. And what does the pattern say after that? Change the state. So what's our shared state? Locked becomes true. Excellent. And what does the pattern say after that? Notify as needed. Now, is there any possibility that someone is waiting here and I need to notify them in this example? Intuitively, why am I notifying? I'm notifying because I just changed my shared data. These shared data participate in some condition. I may have turned that condition into false for some other thread. It just so happens that in this case, there's no such possibility. By setting lock to true, I can never have turned that condition from true to false. I can never cause someone else to not wait. But you really need to think about this before you're sure. It's only in this case that this is the case. In this example, that we can be so sure that this is the case. So here, there's no need for signaling inside the acquire operation. So what do I need to do? What do I need to do for the release? Locked becomes false. And I heard people say notify. C.notify. Now, why not notify all?
Because there is only, at any moment, there is only one thread in the created section, and it can be any of them, any of those waiting.
So we will see, you put it great. We will see that there's a very strict condition for weakening a notify all into a notify. And it's very, very easy to get that wrong. I guarantee you that you will get it wrong at least once in something very trivial. So the condition is we can use notify instead of notify all when any thread can make progress, and we know that only one will. So any thread can make progress. They're all indistinguished. The ones that are waiting to acquire the ones that are waiting on the condition, any of them can make progress equally well. And once the first one makes progress, no one else can. And that's exactly what we have in this example. In this example, because it's a mutex we are building, only one thread will make progress. And all the threads are the same, because they all wait on the same condition here. Doesn't matter if I have 10 threads that wait on this condition, doesn't matter which one I notify.
So that is c.wait, right?
I'm sorry, c.wait, yes. That would be the right thing based on the syntax we had before. So we will see this in more detail, but the point I want to raise is notify is safe here. But it's safe exactly because of the properties of this example. It's not generally safe. Generally, the safe thing is to do notify all. When in doubt, do notify all. Wake up all of them and put the burden of correctness to the person who writes these while conditions. Yes?
In general, what's the hazard of choosing
to
notify all?
The hazard is having a deadlock. You don't wake up someone who, according to your synchronization protocol, should be able to make progress. You don't know what the thread you don't wake up should do. It may be a garbage collection thread. It may be necessary for the whole program to make progress. So it's a subtle form of not quite deadlock, but not ensuring your progress protocol. So it's a really, really serious problem and very subtle one. Are we good with that? Did I forget anything? I think we're good.
Can you describe again what is the difference between notify and notify all?
So notify will only wake up one thread that's waiting on this condition variable, one thread that's sleeping, and you don't know which one. Notify all will wake them all up, and it will let them all fight among themselves to acquire the lock and try to make progress.
But when just only one can proceed, what is the difference between two? It doesn't matter, do you notify one or do you notify all? Only one can proceed.
That's exactly why we use notify there, because only one can proceed in this example. But if I had some other example where half the threads can proceed, or 10 threads may be able to proceed, then I should have used notify all. And we will see examples with all of those. All my examples on the slides are designed to illustrate different things. So all these different variations. OK. So back to the presentation. So I'm out of time, so I'll try to give you some examples for home that we will work on tomorrow. Now, the classic example of all monitor-style programming is a reader's-writer's lock. This is a critical section that implements the following protocol. I can have any number of readers in the critical section, so threads that call the enter-read method before the critical section and the exit-read afterwards. They can be as many as you want. So I have infinite concurrency for readers in my protocol. Any number of threads can go in as readers. But readers, of course, read the data. And I have only one writer. That's the reader's writer's lock. Now, I'm kind of showing you the solution here, but the point will be we will go over it on the board quickly tomorrow. But what I do want you to think about, people who have done multi-thread programming have probably done reader's writer's lock because it's a very standard example. Try to refresh your memory about it. If you have not done multi-thread programming, everything we saw before, especially the last example, has prepared you. You can now do this. And you can now do the following ones as well, because we will get to those next time. So it may be good to think about the following two problems. And if you want, keep notes on that. Just like a reader's writer's lock, I want you to think about two other kinds of critical sections. One is a critical section with two kinds of threads. Just like we had readers and writers, now we have red and green threads. And I chose those names because the red and the green pen here are really visible from back there. So we will be able to write on the board very well. So this is an easy example, the first one. We have up to three threads in critical section. Only we have the restriction that not all three can be the same color. Write the pseudocode for that. Or prepare it in your mind. We will try to do it in class. It's going to go much better if you've thought a little about it, because you'll see what you might have gotten wrong. And that's especially the case for the second one. The second protocol is, I also have red and green threads, up to three in the critical section. But red threads have priority, and the meaning of red have priority is that the green threads implement the following protocol. They never enter the critical section if there is a red thread that is waiting. The red tried to enter, but it couldn't because there were already three in there, and now it's waiting. Then it means no green can enter before that red can enter. That's a progress protocol that you're implementing. So if you think about those two examples, they will reveal a lot of things about what is hard, together with the readers, writers. And that will be the topic of the next. And in the final lecture, we'll think about transactional memory and how some things become much easier with transactional memory. Questions? Yeah?
When reasoning about parallel programs, is there any advantage for message passing or shared memory approach over each other when you want to do reasoning?
Much easier for reasoning. Message passing effectively means you remove all the complications of shared memory. You reason about everything with no mutable storage that is shared. So you can do very functional reasoning. You can just isolate your different agents. So yeah, definitely message passing is much, much cleaner. The only problem is that it's not as general. You cannot get the full power of your shared memory architecture. And right now, we have shared memory in hardware. And we will, for the next 10 years probably, have multi-core architectures. It's a pity to not be able to exploit that.
So we can adapt that you can implement shared memory with message passing, where the shared memory is the actor and the load and store of these messages.
Correct. But that
you lose, again, all the performance advantages, because you need a message for every read or write to a memory word.
Right, but you still have race conditions and deadlock at the message level.
Correct. Yeah, so you're right. So basically, you're saying, if you want to write ugly code in a message passing way, code that is not verifiable, you can certainly do it. So yes, I fully agree with that. I shouldn't have said generally it's more verifiable. But generally, it is easier. If your algorithm can be specified in a message passing way, it is easier to reason about that. OK. Thank you.